This is Michael Matheson Miller, and you are listening to the Moral Imagination Podcast.
Thank you again for listening to the Moral Imagination Podcast. I'm delighted to have as my guest today, Deacon Gurian. We'll talk about his bio in a second. A couple of points. First of all, if you like the podcast, please do give it a five-star review at Apple Podcasts. And also, as I've mentioned before, I have a new newsletter. I send it out maybe once or twice a month. You can subscribe at themoralimagination.com. And of course, as always, show notes for this episode and all episodes you can find at themoralimagination.com. So as I said, I'm delighted to have as my guest today, Professor Deacon Gurian. He is a professor or a retired professor of theology and ethics at Loyola College in Baltimore at the University of Virginia, has taught at numerous places. He's a senior fellow at the Russell Kirk Center and is the author of a number of books, including the one we're going to talk today, Tending the Heart of Virtue, How Classical Stories Awaken a Child's Moral Imagination. This was first done in 1998, but he's just released last year a expanded and revised edition of the book, which we're going to talk about. It's a great book. I read it many years ago, and I just read it again in preparation for this podcast. I highly recommend it. He has also written other books, a couple books on gardening, one called Inheriting Paradise, which I like very much, and then a more recent one, 2006, called The Fragrance of God, which I have not yet read, but I'm looking forward to it. So I'm delighted to have Professor Gurian on the show. Thank you so much for joining the Moral Imagination Podcast.
It's good to be with you.
Okay, so let's just start with the big picture, and then we'll go into some of the ideas here. You tell us about this book, Tending the Heart of Virtue, is really about fairy tales and classical stories and awakening the moral imagination. And so why don't you give us the big picture? What was the inspiration to write this book, and why did you think it was needed? And second, why did you think, and also your editors think, that an expanded, revised edition now about 25 years later was still relevant and important?
Well, the evolution of the book really begins with reading to my own children, who are now in their 40s and have children of their own. So this book is, second edition, is actually dedicated to my grandchildren, as the first edition was great. Dedicated to my children. Well, I at the point at which I wasn't able to be reading to them, they were reading on their own and were not asking me every evening to read to them, I got lonely. And I decided I'd like to teach those stories in the classroom. That was when I was at Loyola College. Of course, retired from UVA a couple of years back. Well, 5 years back now. So I started to teach a course that I call Religion in Children's Literature. And that course I've taught for over 25 years, both at Loyola and Virginia. And it was a very popular course. It wasn't an easy course. I had them writing constantly, but they loved it. In fact, at UVA, the last year I taught it, I limited to 30. There were 150 on the wait list.
Wow.
Which proves to me that these stories are not just for small children by any stretch. And then, the first edition came out probably 5 years into teaching that course, maybe a little longer. And it sold very well at the start, slowed down in the middle, but never stopped selling. Got translated into Portuguese and most recently Romanian. It's actually the Portuguese is Brazilians. There's a classical school movement down in Brazil, and some of those folks contacted me, asked to get translated. So, 25 years later, I always thought of doing a second edition. My editor, Cynthia Reed at Oxford, she was the head of religion and philosophy at the time, I promised her I'd do something in the future. So a generation later, I decided what I would do is instead of writing a second book, I would supplement this one considerably. There's over 120 new pages in it because the thesis about the moral imagination and how stories can instill the virtues in children was intact in that book. I give it to another generation refreshed.
Well, why don't you go over that? What is your main thesis about how children's stories and fairy tales especially are so very important for shaping moral imagination? And maybe we could talk briefly about what is or what do you mean by the moral imagination? Obviously, the line comes from the famous Edmund Burke, that we've emptied the wardrobe of the immoral imagination. So maybe you could talk about the immoral imagination and then why children's literature is so very important in it.
Well, as I said, these stories that are in the book, I mean, they range from the Velveteen Rabbit to Cinderella to the Lewis's Narnia Chronicles to Pinocchio, et cetera, et cetera. All of these stories have been thought to be for children. They're not exclusively for children. I think it was Lewis who said if they're exclusively for children, they're not very good, probably.
Right, right.
Now, but in the case of children, I think that children are open to the concrete. They don't go to abstraction the way adults do. And in the concrete, they find symbols. That's where symbols are located. They're not located in abstraction. They're located in the concrete, and they find them. Children have a way of finding symbols that adults have forgotten. Children have a way of using symbolic language inside, and it's inspired by the concrete. Children are driven by narratives. They'll ask you to repeat over and over again. An adult will read it once and say, well, what's the kernel in there that I need to hold on to? I think children in that sense are better listeners, if not better readers, than adults. So these stories have a particular impact on them, I think, because of the concreteness. I would say fairy tales are the most concrete of stories available to children. And we hazard not introducing fairy tales to them. Now, the moral imagination, yes, they find the narrative, but the inspiration they get, it's not just simply the triumph of good over evil. I think the inspiration they get is from the characters that are in these stories, the characters who struggle with good and evil and are victorious in the end, and the example that they set for children in when they hear these stories. So it's the characters that I focus on in the book, although I obviously give you some idea of the narrative. In fact, in some cases, a lot of the narrative, I come back to the characters. There is a character analysis or study there, because that's where adults can be informed as to what the power of these characters in these stories are, the protagonists and the antagonists. And children follow this very closely, more so than we think. I think they have the ability to, because they're not distracted by other things.
You talk about this a bit, like when you were teaching, I think at Loyola, maybe later at University of Virginia, some of your students, like they struggled with metaphor and with symbols. Yes. And you talked about how that they themselves, when they watched children read it, were surprised, saying, wow, these fourth graders understand the stories better than we do. I mean, they were kind of shocked.
I brought my class to, I think it was the fourth grade, was it third or fourth grade class, my daughter's class at St. Paul's School in Baltimore at the time. Yeah, we visited the children. They had read this Pinocchio over a much longer period of time than my class. But when we were all finished, we got together. Yes, and there were conversations that took place. They did posters of certain scenes in Pinocchio, and they even organized themselves and enacted out some of these scenes. But in the process of all of that, my college students, when we were back in the classroom at Loyola, expressed real surprise at the insight that the children had into these stories, and realized that in some sense they were blind to this, or they were deaf to some of these moments in stories that are really significant, insight into Pinocchio's behavior that children are quite familiar with, you see, because they behave a lot like Pinocchio, and they know that they're sort of like puppets on string. They themselves are sort of marionettes that are controlled by others, that is, the adults that see after them. And the interest in Pinocchio is much greater in a young child than it is in an adult. adults can get bored with the Pinocchio. They're scene after scene, episode after episode, and he fails, and then he succeeds, and then he fails, and then that's what children love. Adults don't like that. That's bad to conduct your life that way. Why? But that's how you learn. That's how you learn.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
And also, point I made in that was that the children also understood quickly that Pinocchio was a liar, but also didn't understand things that he wasn't able to understand. And they understood that Pinocchio needed to be able to understand himself and tell the story the right way, account for himself. And children are always having to account for themselves. That's what parents say, why did you do that? my college students were shocked at what little they understood and how much the children understood.
Well, you also said something too that if I remember this correctly, and that was that there was both an understanding, like you just articulated, of the students, the children could understand, well, you know, Pinocchio told a lie, but he also doesn't know stuff, but also the children were in one sense, so they were more sympathetic and more harsh in the facts that they said, well, no, it's a lie and it's wrong. And the college students and adults tend to be both, how do you say, less willing to say that's bad, but also less understanding. So it's an interesting conundrum.
Impatient with, I would say, adults. Impatient with Pinocchio. The children are, here again, we go back to what children are really impressed by. They live inside of the narrative. They want the narrative told over and over again, the story, but it is the characters that they get inside of or get inside of them. And so in the case of Pinocchio, they identify very strongly with Pinocchio. They know that in some sense he's controlled by forces outside of himself, which he has a little equipment to deal with. He's inexperienced. On the other hand, they understand that he's recalcitrant and he shouldn't be making those mistakes. But they're also interested in how he gets himself out of trouble. Children love to puzzle that sort of thing out. Now, how is he going to get himself out of trouble? But they're critical if you call him on it as to how he gets himself out of trouble. If it's not in an honest way, it doesn't have integrity, they know it. They know it. They know they've done the same thing. And they grow as Pinocchio grows in the story. They mature with Pinocchio vicariously, but they do. We don't as adults. We're impatient. Get on with it. It's a rogue's tale. Yes, it is in part. But it's not a rogue's tale because by the end, Pinocchio has understood who he is, has narrated his own identity with integrity when he's in the belly of the shark with Geppetto and becomes a responsible young boy, even before he's flesh and bone.
Right, which, as you say in your chapter on Pinocchio, is essential to understanding the story. That it's the becoming good that is the beginning of his, in a sense, humanity.
Exactly.
And now he's on this progress, which is different from the Disney film, which...
Well, in the Disney film, becoming good's there.
For sure. Yeah.
The Pinocchio in Disney, he's an American innocent. Mm-hmm. Pinocchio, as Collodi portrays him, is an Augustinian sinner, in a sense. Or the fact that even children aren't in harmony with the world the way they ought to be and have to learn and mature through experiences. That's what I was, but also I think in Collodi's story, what's at the heart of it is actually the question of being a good son to one's father. Yeah. That's what Pinocchio in the end is, a good son, not just good, but in the relationship to Geppetto.
Yeah. So let's do this. I want to go back into Pinocchio. So let me pause. I'm going to bracket that for just a second because I want to at least just spend a little bit more time on the argument in your first couple chapters of fairy tales. And then we'll go into Pinocchio, because I want to talk about Pinocchio, the Disney movie Pinocchio, which is, I think, better than a lot of the other Disney.
Yes, it is. It has Disney behind it. The genius of Disney himself.
Yeah. But also, you know, I think there's some theological things that I want to ask you about that as well. But let's before we go into the detail of Pinocchio, you make in actually the first chapter of your book, you make this point about awakening the moral imagination, and you quote Flannery O'Connor and you say, a story is a way to tell something that can't be said any other way because a statement would be inadequate. And then you quote the philosopher Alistair MacIntyre, and he said, and this in many ways is one of the arguments of your book in a paragraph form from MacIntyre. It's through learning about wicked stepmothers, lost children, good but misguided kings, wolves that suckle twin boys, youngest sons who receive no inheritance, et cetera, that children learn or mislearn what a child and what a parent is, what the cast of characters may be in the drama into which they have been born, and what the ways of the world are. If you deprive children of stories, you leave them unscripted, anxious stutterers in their actions as in their words. That's
exactly.
MacIntyre.
Right.
And John Senior actually makes a case about later saying you don't want to send your daughters, I think he spoke speaking, but daughters and sons, into the world as too naive. So they need to read good literature so they can experience the deception, difficulty, challenges of the world, so that when they get in the world, they're not naive. And I think those two align.
That's correct.
And then you talk about how Martin Buber, the Jewish philosopher, realized he was making mistakes in giving instructions in ethics. He was trying to teach formal rules and principles. And he said, every time I do that, I could feel their resistance. He said, if I explain that it's bad or wicked to bully the weak, I could see a suppressed smile on the lips of the strong, right? Mm-hmm. I try to explain lying destroys life, and the worst habitual liar of class produces a brilliant essay on the destructive power
of lying.
And so you give this idea of the Greek word for character is an impression. And so that part of the idea is that the stories create an impression. They impress themselves upon the soul, the intellect of not just children, but adults, but especially children. And that gives them a vision of the moral life much richer than, say, you know, a syllogism would.
All right. Let me help out a little bit here. Good. Yeah. Okay. Children don't have the ability, because their world is limited by guardians who rightfully protect them, to have the kinds of fully experience the world. Their worlds are limited in that sense, and their experiences are going to be limited. So what MacIntyre was saying is that we need to give them stories through which they can grow into the world, experiences that they can use later in order to navigate their way through the world. That's extremely important. And if we give them bad stories, such as this culture is doing, we're doing great harm, not only to their minds, but to their souls. I have a really strong feeling about how much we're hurting children by the quality of the stories we're giving them. Awful, awful.
And, it's like a bad map, so that when they get in the world, they have a very bad map and they can't navigate complexity.
It's an industry now.
Yeah.
Whether it's in print, but also video. I mean, what Disney produces, the junk that it produces that children consume, apart from its cinema projects, is junk. And there's worse junk than that out there. Stories
that are
told by idiots, really. Stories told by idiots at the best. At the worst, they're stories told by people who have an agenda as to what they want children to become. And parents put their hands into these people and these voices and these stories. And that's why I insist that fairy tales are solid. They may seem tough, but children understand that. They understand tough love. They understand inherently what the consequences of acting poorly are. And they want to be instructed. And they take those stories, but particularly those characters and the memories of them, into their lives. And this is where the moral imagination is formed. These are memories. These are images that are stored up. We don't do it consciously. It happens. And then when something happens in our life, we try to make sense of it. And we those memories become analogies by which we can negotiate what happens to us later in life. Those are moral judgments that we're able to make, moral perception, moral seeing, spiritual seeing, through those metaphors, through those memories. Yes. I quote in the second edition, I don't think it's in the first, George Santayana, and his way of putting this, this is the 20th century philosopher. Perceptions fall into the brain rather as seeds into a furrowed field or even as sparks into a keg of powder. Each image in turn gives birth to more images, sometimes slowly and subterraneously, sometimes when a passionate train is started with a sudden burst of fancy. So they're there. Mm-hmm. And memories are important for children in their later lives. The right sorts of memories. And at the toward the end of the Brothers Karamazov, the youngest brother, who has brought together these children that have been sort of at war in the with themselves in the village, takes them to the grave of, or the stone that was in memory of one of their colleagues, friends who dies. And he says, Alyosha says to the children, he says, just one good memory in your childhood can be your redemption. And that's very true. One good memory.
Yeah, so you, it's, I think, very important. I think that was a good articulation that it creates this, this, I liked how you said that the, and now memories, these ideas, and create memories, which create analogies to negotiate the moral complexities.
Yeah, they offer up analogies.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an exercise, you know, it's what a human being is at his best. We have the, we were able to use our memories that way. Yeah. To draw up analogies when we need them in order to guide us in our actions, in our attitudes, perhaps much later than those memories that may have come in childhood, for example.
Right.
This we all do this. We're not conscious of it. I've just thought I've been more conscious of it. I wanted to think about it.
Yeah. I think it relates to C.S. Lewis's Abolition of Man when he talks about the chest, right? So the head rules the belly through the chest. And you talk about the heart in the book, but this idea of the chest. So the way I sometimes explain it when I teach this is that you have the intellect has an idea, right? Yeah. Like, you know, I should be brave or I should be faithful. And then the belly is like a 500 pound gorilla that has I want. Mm-hmm. And the intellect says, pardon me, you're not allowed to do that. Actually, the catechism says, no, don't you remember paragraph, you know, whatever. And of course, the gorilla just crushes it. I want. But it's the chest of Lewis's articulation, the tripartite, that with nobility and attachment to the hearth and these memories, these analogies, these ideas, these inspirations, the impressions that help us overcome that temptation and in a sense align with our reason. And I think in that sense, it's not just our personal experiences, but the good stories of our youth that also serve that chest. Just as McIntyre says, you're not going to have little children experience, or you hope not, the horrid, deep, terrible experience of the world. They have to, you want them to experience it through fairy tales. So too, you want to experience this nobility to prepare them for the future.
Yes, correct. Yeah. Yep, that's what it's about. And most of these memories that come up to consciousness in our lives, we don't draw them up quite consciously at all. They emerge. And we use them in order to navigate our way through problems, issues that arise, confrontations, moments where we need to be receptive to the needs of others and so forth.
Great. And you, another point you mentioned that the moral imagination, you say, is not a thing, not even a faculty. as the very process by which the self makes metaphors out of images given by experience and then employs these metaphors to find and suppose moral correspondence in experience. Yes. The moral imagination is active for well or ill, strong or weak, every moment of our lives, in our sleep as well as when we're awake. And absolutely, there's like Aristotle talks about this too, right? Like in yes, Thomas Aquinas, that yes, like our sleep. But it needs nurture and proper exercise. Otherwise, it will atrophy like a muscle that is not used. The richness or poverty of the moral imagination depends on the richness or poverty of experience. And of course, young people can't have that experience, as you point out. So they need good stories.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah, most people do ethics through stories. They don't bring out principles to negotiate an issue with. So if you're sitting in a train or a bus or just in a cafe somewhere, people will tell stories back and forth, but they're actually moralizing or doing ethics in their own way. They're making judgments. Sometimes it's mere gossip, but sometimes it's very important to their lives. And that's how they do it, with stories.
Right.
When you teach ethics in the classroom at the university, so often that human behavior is left behind, but you're dealing with human beings who are themselves going to negotiate these issues in their lives through stories. That's why I introduced so much literature, even poetry, into my ethics courses.
Right.
Filled it with them.
I think that's, and also, you know, I talk about this in a lecture I give on the moral imagination, which for listeners, if you haven't heard, there's a podcast I give on the moral imagination. And I think it's also another important point is that, you know, both Russell Kirk, Burke Elliott, Irving Babbitt talk about this idea. There's the moral imagination, but there's also the idyllic imagination and the diabolical imagination. Mm-hmm. And when the moral imagination is not formed, it's not just a vacuum, right? That opens the door to the idyllic imagination, which often I argue actually always descends into the diabolical.
Well, okay. So spiders will always make webs, and they will make the web as they need it and in the right form. The imagination is with us all the time and the formation of it, but it can be deformed. So the exercise of imagination can be self-destructive in the human individual. That's the difference between a human being and a spider. We're going to use our imaginations, but what kind of imagination do we have? And there are different forms of imagination that are and some of them are incredibly destructive. I add to that cast of characters the idolatrous imagination, which is everywhere in our culture now. I mean, the very notion that we've taken the word icon, which has a religious meaning, and turned it into to distinguish an icon from an idol, shall we say. But we speak of our stars, there's another one, as icons. But they're really idols. They're misnamed.
Yes. Why don't you explain the difference? Can you explain the difference?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about icon in the sense of Christian religious art, what's portrayed in the icon is not the worldly flesh, but the spiritual flesh of the saints or of Christ. It is an image into which we enter to be elevated, to be transfigured, to be perfected. An idol leads us away from the good, the true, the good, and the beautiful. It leads us away from that. And where our culture is filled with idols, they're scattered everywhere. You whether it come through your eyes or whether they come through your ears, they enter, and they form the idolatrous imagination, for example.
So let's maybe, I want to get into like the stories, but maybe one more thing. You've mentioned this a couple times, so maybe this is a good time to address it, is that the problem, and this I think is related to why you reissued the book, is that there's a lot of children's literature out there, but a lot of it is actually very harmful. It's the combination of like either idyllic imagination, which is this idea almost that you can, it's like a create heaven on earth. You can establish these incredible things. But as I explained, it often then when it fails, because it always fails, the Tower of Babel fails, it then descends into the diabolical imagination, which is destructive. And so the idolatrous, I am assuming you're going to argue, would also go, either it's going to be reformed into the moral imagination or it's going to descend into the diabolical. Maybe not. You can tell me if you think that or not. And then, but what would be some examples of some children's literature today? So you've argued, and we're going to talk about, like, and by the way, for listeners, I will put a list of books in the show notes that you can to see some of the books that Professor Gurian recommends. So obviously Pinocchio, you talk about the Hans Christian Andersen, George MacDonald, C.S. Lewis books, of course.
Grimm's
fairy tales, all the fairy tales, like maybe
Kenneth
Blue
Grimm's
fairy,
The Wind in the Willows,
right?
Etc.
Yeah, exactly. And I'll put a list of those, and we can talk about some of them.
Charlotte's Web.
Yeah. But what books today that are very popular in children's literature do you think are problems?
You have to understand that I'm not raising small children, so I don't go to the library looking for books to give to my children. What I can say is this, that the fairy tales have been Baudelaireized, and virtually any picture book you get of a fairy tale, a classic fairy tale, has been reduced considerably, and in some sense, they're honest enough to say they're rewritten.
Right.
If they want to name it, what I object to most of all is they give the same name to what they've retold. They ought to name it something else, but they couldn't sell it otherwise. So there are a lot of...
What's an example?
The worst has to be The Ugly Duckling, which I discuss under the topic of the triumph of beauty in the second edition.
Yep, that's a beautiful chapter, yep.
Inevitably, The Ugly Duckling is rewritten by following a prejudice or an opinion about what that story is really about. And what most people conclude is it's about bullying or being the disenfranchised. And that has purchase. I don't question it. But if that's all you see when you attempt to retell that story, you eliminate episodes in The Ugly Duckling, which lead us to a different conclusion, another conclusion about the story, which is that the love of beauty makes one beautiful. And every version of The Ugly Duckling that I've seen in the bookstores and in the libraries eliminates one particular episode, which I talked to, which gives us a suggestion as to why The Ugly Duckling is not merely a victim, but a victor.
Right. Well, you talk about that Sehnsucht, right? This longing for beauty.
Yes.
And this desire, right? And that, why don't you talk about that a little bit? Because I think it's not that, obviously there's bullying taking place, right?
Yes.
I would also argue that you sometimes get false senses of identity of the, you know, that you just create your own identity, but that's not also what the Ugly Duckling is. There's an essential structure of his swanness that he hasn't realized.
That's right.
Right. But his love of beauty and other things open, and all these experiences open him up to actually become who he actually is, not this false sense of identity that somehow you've got the secret self inside you.
To identify with the swans that he sees, not once, but twice. And in every version I've seen of The Ugly Duckling, not just in picture books, but many times in collections, only one of those incidents occurs. And that's at the end of the story. But if you eliminate the first incident, you don't realize what has drawn the ugly duckling to these swans so that he flies toward them or moves toward them at the end of the story. And it's beauty. It's the beauty of the swans. The wonderful thing that Andersen does is he makes the story is a story of transformation, but it's not the usual magic of the fairy tales, the Frog Prince, for example, or Beauty and the Beast. And yet we feel this same sense of elevation and joy for the ugly duckling that we do for those other characters. It's a trick that he plays on us. It's a wonderful trick. But you won't understand that unless you read the whole story. And that's the problem. It's his love of beauty. It's his nobility. His nobility is not to be a victim. His nobility is not in the misnaming of himself as the ugly duckling. That's not it. His nobility is his love for beauty and what it moves him toward in life, ultimately. So he says... Go ahead.
Ability to, you say, sorry, to quote you, you say, like the Velveteen Rabbit, the ugly duckling resists bitterness, jealousy, and resentfulness, and instead grows in humility and gratitude for the beautiful world that he has been given. Yeah. That's why we forget the inevitableness of his physical train and rejoice in the alteration of his appearance as a genuine transformation, a gift from some higher power for the duckling's love of beauty. His willingness even to abandon himself just to be near beauty, right? And you connected, of course, to like C.S. Lewis and other works that, and Augustine, and this like desire for the good. And that too, I think is a much richer reading of the story than simply he like bullying is bad, which it is. Also like false senses of identity that, as I said before, like your real self is somehow hidden inside of you. I think it's Anthony Daniels. Theodore Dalrymple says, you know, we always talk about our real self is only the good things we do. Not like I was obnoxious and difficult. That's also my real self. But also this false notions of identity that somehow like, and what the book is doing is something much richer than that. And that gets missed by this kind of banal limitations or, again, almost transhumanist false senses of liberation and identity. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, the ugly duckling adopts this name for himself that's debilitating, but it doesn't overcome him. He holds on to himself sufficiently so that he makes the right sort of decision and is led to the swans ultimately, whom he views as extraordinarily beautiful, has no notion that he's one of them until he is transformed by genetics into a beautiful white swan. But the point is that he, his own agent, he is not defeated. He is not a victim. To think of him as a victim is false. He triumphs. Now at the end, he moves toward them still, even at that moment where he's already been transformed but doesn't see himself in the water, he moves toward them and he says, they can kill me if they like. He wants to be with them. He wants to join them. Now, Jack Zipes, who's written on fairy tales and translated the Grimms, which is a good translation, by the way, I use it, says that the ugly duckling wants to kill himself. This is absurd. He will give himself over to beauty even if it means his own end. It's not a desire to die at all. It's a desire to be with something grand, something beautiful. Total misinterpretation. He's suicidal. Where he gets that from, I don't know. It astonishes me. But it's rooted in a kind of ideological reading of the story, which is both, which is really, one hand, Marxist, and another hand, psychological. It's astonishing. But this is the point. This is the point. When people start to retell these stories, the ideology enters into the retelling. And Dickens in 1850 objected to this when the fairy tales were being retold in order to support the temperance union movement. So he said, if this is allowed, we will lose the stories. And these stories ennoble us in all sorts of ways, which he lists. Now, we've lost the stories. We don't even know what the stories are. Well, that's one of the things that happens in my classroom in college. What? I thought it was that whether it's Disney or whether it's a picture book that was read to them. We've lost the stories. If you lose the stories, Dickens said, if we lose the stories, England will be lost. Okay. That's how strongly he felt about fairy tales. Mind you, he wrote fairy tales, long ones called novels. Beautiful. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think it's that Plato has something to this effect that if we lose the concept of the good in music and dance, the whole educational project, Greek or foreign, is compromised. And I think that's connected to this sense. If you lose the story and the deeper meanings, you begin to lose your culture and your civilization.
Yourself.
So it's not, it's, yeah. And yourself. And it's not, as it were, it's not, I mean, it sounds like, oh, a big statement, but it really does connect. If your argument is right, it does connect to the moral imagination and then an understanding of how to live in the world of good, evil, and complexity, and how to do
that. What do you learn from the Ugly Duckling? You don't learn that he is suicidal.
No.
What you learn from the Ugly Duckling is that he has courage in the deepest sense. He has courage, the courage to move toward the good and the beautiful and the true. That's what he's doing. He's a noble character.
It also comes up, you see this a little bit in some of the psychological readings that you give a couple of different examples, but you know, there's...
And mind you, my editor told me to cut a lot of that out 25 years ago, and she was right, because the book would have been an academic's argument. And she
yeah.
knew it didn't serve the purpose that the book
but,
was...
But it is, but I do think it's at least worth talking about just briefly, because...
Yeah, of course, I left some of it in.
Well, one of the things that you see is these, like, there's these readings, these kind of psychological debunking readings, right? It's almost like the academic has to, and I'll be here a little critical, but, you know, the academic's like, I have to make my name and I'm going to write this, like, kind of, you know, sociological or psychological analysis of what the real problems are, or, you know, what I think it's Hans Christian Andersen's the Little Mermaid, the idea that, you know, somehow he's just turning this woman into like a sexual object and et cetera, and like missing the point of the story. By the way, I would say, like, as a,
The Little Mermaid, again, to illustrate how we've lost the story, I dare to say that most of your listeners, the only image of the Little Mermaid they have is of the Disney version, which is a complete emasculation of the story and romantic nonsense. That's where Disney's hand was not in it. Disney read the fairy tales. He gave us something we'd never seen before, and I have to give him credit for that. Snow White, and also, Cinderella. They're not the same story, but he understood what these stories were about.
Like Pinocchio, right? Like Pinocchio.
Pinocchio is another one. I turned him into an American innocent. I'm forgiving of this, maybe more so than I ought to be, but I know that he created something new and beautiful. And boy, the technology is not as good as those guys drawing those images.
Whereas the Little Mermaid, right, it loses the whole point of the story.
Oh, that's a totally emasculation of the story. But I would say most of you brought up the Little Mermaid, and how many people have read the Little Mermaid, the whole of it?
Well, and I think as you explain, not only is the psychological kind of critique boring and just that kind of an approach at debunking, but it misses the whole point of sacrifice, what sacrifice is.
Exactly.
And how she offers herself up. Like, she's tempted, right? The sisters and the witch
are in league at the end.
And they say, listen, just kill him and you get your 300 years back. And she won't do it. Not doing that, she's actually lifted up.
She's
again, this goes
and raised.
Yeah, she's ennobled, or she's raised up. And there's something in this core of many of these stories that unless you die to yourself,
exactly, right,
you will have you'll
the Little Mermaid and the Ugly Duckling are perfect examples of that, really, because they take the initiative. They're not passive victims or anything like that.
Another thing that I think is also interesting, and this is actually not in your book, but it's in Mitchell Kalpagian's book called The Mysteries of Life in Children's Literature.
I know him well.
Like very much.
What a character.
Yeah. And he does something. He also explains something else that fairy tales do, which I think is, I always thought was very helpful. And I use it in my talks on the moral imagination, is that he makes distinctions between, like, one example is fairy tales teach you the difference between good wishes and bad wishes. And so Cinderella has a good wish. The fisherman's wife, who just wants to be wealthy, has a bad wish. And how good wishes, again, have that ennobling element that raise you to a higher level of being, whereas bad wishes, which are just about your greed, actually end up destroying you. And I think, teaches about that you must give of yourself and not simply try to acquire if you're going to achieve human nobility and also joy, which is a byproduct of love, a superabundant relation, you know, a result of a love relationship, not something that can be grasped. And I think fairy tales, even so, I want to, you know, you actually quote Joseph Pieper, who's one of my favorite modern philosophers. Pieper is such a wonderful thinker, and Pieper's so very good on, and Dietrich von Hildebrand also, on joy as a superabundant byproduct of the love relationship. Joy cannot be grasped. And so I'm actually starting this little project called Philosophy and Catholicism, where I'm just going over some basic philosophical ideas. And one of them is on this question of joy. Well, I can tell you as an adult, joy can't be grasped. And I can explain why in 5 minutes. But the fairy tales impress themselves upon you in a much deeper and profound way, so that it sticks with you as an insight, as a training, in a way that a 5-minute lecture on that is not unhelpful, but it's not going to accomplish the same thing.
No, that's true. And you can't teach that class to children either, but you can do those stories to children and they'll get it. And they'll live with that, the memories of those stories. If you read them once, twice, three times, they'll probably want you to read them more than three times. And when a child asks you to read a story over again, do it. If it's a good story, read it as many times as they ask for it.
That's very, very good. Good, important advice, because sometimes you don't want to. I have little
children. No, let's get again, on to something else.
Again. Again. And I love that you quote that Chesterton line, which I love, when he says, you know, that God is younger than we are. And when the sun comes up, again, do it again. I actually have a 2-year-old, and it's one of his favorite words, like, again, you know, again. And so I think of Chesterton
line. Children bring that to us. They don't learn it from each other. It's inside of them somehow or other. Again.
So let's talk. Maybe we can. So we don't have time to go through all of it. So listeners, I really recommend the book. It's a lovely book. And so you talk about different things going through fairy tales. So I'll just give a quick summary here that, like, for example, chapter 2 is on becoming a real human child, Pinocchio. And what does it mean? Which we'll talk about. Love and immortality, The Velveteen Rabbit and The Little Mermaid. Friends and mentors, The Wind in the Willows, Charlotte's Web, and Bambi. And let's see, the next chapter is evil and redemption, The Snow Queen and The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And then heroines of faith and courage, The Princess and the Goblin, and Lucy in Prince Caspian. So what's really lovely about this book, if for listeners, is that you know, again, a little spoiler alert's going on, but it'll really inspire you to read the stories, but also just helping to articulate. And I think really, it's a really beautiful and inspirational book. So let me
read the last three chapters, which you don't have the book in front of you.
Oh, that's right. The last three chapters, because you added new ones.
The Triumph of Beauty in The Nightingale and The Ugly Duckling, The Goodness of Goodness, The Grim Cinderella and John Ruskin's The King of the Golden River, and Obedience and the Path to Perfection in George MacDonald's The Wise Woman. Incredible story it is.
Right. So those are the three new chapters, right? Which you can get in the revised one, which I only have online, unfortunately, not in a hard copy. But so let's, in our time left, why don't we try to talk about Pinocchio and then friendship, just to give kind of a little bit of insight into how you do the work. So let's talk about the Pinocchio story. And you say that the contemporary children's story writer, Maurice Sendak, judges Disney's Pinocchio is good in that his badness is only a matter of inexperience. And he dislikes Collodi's Pinocchio because the puppet is born bad. You talked about this Augustinian thing. I actually have a question for you. When I read your description of the different kinds of Pinocchios. There's Clodi's Pinocchio, there's Disney's Pinocchio, and then there's kind of this modern reading of the Pinocchio. It's almost like there's a Catholic Orthodox understanding of grace and justification and theosis and divinization in the original. There's a Protestant understanding, because like the new man is pushed away and you're just kind of become good really quickly. And then a lot of modern readers don't like either of those. They have, I'm not sure how I articulated it, but I don't know if it's not so much a transhumanist, but it's really like there's a rejection of any types of a sense of evil. But I think clearly you could see that the Disney one, maybe it's American Innocent, I thought of it as a Protestant idea of justification versus the old one. Yeah. The old one, which is very much Catholic Orthodox theology.
Yeah.
What do you think? Anyway, but why don't you tell me?
Explain. I mean, the classical education that the children received in the mid-19th century, you had to have read probably something of Augustine. You would have read Dante. You would have read the Odyssey and the Iliad. You would have read these things. And in fact, that kind of education still exists in Italy. Not all children get it, but it is offered through the state to children even today. They still hold on to it. So Collodi was influenced by the very sources you're alluding to and the character of his Pinocchio. No question
about
it.
Why don't you talk about this then? So Pinocchio's refers to Geppetto and his father, that, and you mentioned this before, that Collodi, you say, wants his child readers to understand that being a good boy or girl means being in proper relationship to one's parents.
Yes.
Can you develop this a little bit, this in the Pinocchio stories?
Well, it's not just, he has the blue-haired fairy in Collodi's story assumes a motherly role at the end. Before that, Pinocchio thinks of her as his sister. So there's something inside of Pinocchio, even in with his wooden head and all the rest of it, that draws him to these kinds of relationships, filial relationship, relationship to one's own siblings and so forth, which is the essence, is right at the heart of our humanity. And So when Sendak says it's a dark tale, it's not at all. In the end, it's an affirmation of the inherent goodness of human beings. Even Pinocchio, who is so frustratingly falls into one bad situation after another. But I keep pointing it out. What also Collodi does, which is brilliant, is genius, is that Pinocchio has to learn to tell his own story with integrity. And this ultimately entails relationships to others, responsibility towards others, and a love of those others. And so it's not a dark tale. I always find it, I think Where the Wild Things Are is a classic. And I always find it interesting and kind of amusing that Sendak objects to Collodi's Pinocchio, and then again, MacDonald's The Wise Woman, which is about two recalcitrant little girls, one a princess and one a shepherd's daughter, objects to them as being dark. He writes a story like Where the Wild Things Are. I think it's a wonderful story about how we have to come to terms with our own passions and so forth and so on. How he gets from one to the other, I don't know. I give him credit for having written a classic. There's no question about it, both the pictures and the script and the narrative, the story itself. So I don't know why.
Yeah. You talk, a couple of themes come in here, and one of them you've just mentioned, that you have to tell a true story about yourself. And I think this is actually something that's a challenge in growing up. I mean, I know when you look back at a situation that happened, whether you're as a child, like, and you have to articulate exactly what you did and not make excuses, but even as you get older, two things I think happen. Can we really be honest at telling exactly what happened, trying to be honest with ourselves so we can have prudence to see the world as it is, but also even in the memories of ourselves. Like, you know, there's this, I think it was a Pizza Hut commercial about this man telling the story of how he kicked the field goal. And it went from, it was like a, I think he missed it or he made it, but it was like a, he almost, it's like just lucky, to keeps getting bigger and bigger. And every year it gets bigger until he's like on the 60, he's, you know, it's a 50 yard line. It's like a 60 yard kick from the 50 yard line, and it's snowing and, you know, everything, and he does and he wins. And a lot of times we have we create false images of ourselves. We forget. And I think that this idea of remembrance and clarity,
well, look,
where he has to tell the truth.
We cannot narrate our own lives truthfully and accurately in some sense. The narrative brings together a unity. That's what a good story is. It has a unity to it. If we can't find a unity in our own life, we live rogue's tales. We live as a rogue's tale, one incident after another. And Pinocchio is in jeopardy of that, as each and every one of us is. There again, that's the power of stories. The power of story is to bring to light what a story, the satisfaction in story, the meaning in story. And the same needs to hold true in our own lives.
Well, you say here too that in Geppetto, Pinocchio doesn't just himself, but he saves his father, mm-hmm. right? And then he says to his father is despairing of ever escaping. But Pinocchio has gone through this, he says, death and redeeming hand of a loving and forgiving providence. So he says to his father, give it a try and you'll see. In any case, if it's written in heaven that we must die, at least we'll have the great consolation of dying clasped together, quote unquote. And you said, Joseph Pieper writes, every brave deed draws sustenance from preparedness for death as from the deepest root. And he talks about how to be brave is not the same thing to have no fear, right? And you go on with quoting Pieper. Yeah. But I think that, like, it's the relationship, the proper, maybe you could talk about this, explain this a little bit. So there's a proper relationship of Pinocchio to his father, but in that proper relationship, there's the father too develops. Could you talk about that?
Yes, I think that's right. I didn't emphasize that probably enough, but Geppetto goes out seeking his son, even as his son is going out seeking his father, as Telemachus does in the Odyssey. I think by virtue of his own suffering and near death in the belly of the shark, we call it a whale, he comes to some understanding of what the needs of his son really are. Because in the beginning, he's impatient with Pinocchio and he's put in jail. Why is he put in jail? He's not a threat to his own son, but maybe it's a metaphor of sorts. Yeah. Parents who don't have enough compassion and understanding and enough patience with their children ought to be put in jail. And he has to learn, much as Pinocchio has to learn. That's true.
Yeah, there's a lot with Pinocchio, and I know we're about out of time, but maybe just the last thing we could talk about is that I think is also really important, is you talk about friendship on your chapter on The Wind in the Willows, Charlotte's Web, and Bambi. Yes. And you break down three kinds of, well, friendship. Two, but it's about three kinds of friendship. So one is the friendship of equality, where Mole, through his friendship with Rat and Badger, everybody, he becomes Toad, exactly. And he, good old Toad, and he begins to flourish. And you have this lovely quote with like meaning. Aristotle says, it helps the young to keep from error. It aids activities that are failing from weakness. Those in the prime of life, it stimulates to noble actions. We're two going together, for with friends, men are more able to think and act. And so you have this importance for friendship. And then in Charlotte's Web and in Bambi, the idea of the mentor and two kinds of mentors, the kind of motherly, loving mentor, and then the stag, who's like a monk. He's alone. He has to learn to be alone. And I think this is a beautiful section of friendship. Maybe we could end just talking about perhaps a surprising element of what fairy tales do, and these classic stories, is they affirm the importance of friendship and teach friendship and the value of friendship. Because, you know, we see in the United States, there's, and the Western world, increasing loneliness. people are alone. People are in, you know, and into their devices or into their like disembodied, disembedded experiences. They're smaller families, so people really feel lonely. And there's a lot of data on this. The lonely American is an element, but friendship is so important. And fairy tales stress the important friendship. But do they also teach us how to be a better friend?
Yeah, well, they do. But you're right about the culture. 25 years ago, I didn't see it as much as I do now, and I didn't change this. I didn't attempt to rewrite any of those chapters. I edited them where I thought they needed editing. But so I didn't add that. But friendship is in jeopardy in our culture because we sit in front of a screen, for example, and children do, and get used to it. My God. But there are other reasons why friendship among children diminishes, I think. Actually, I think the organization of play so that it's no longer play is another reason why children maybe are deprived of deep friendships, where they might have them if they were just let alone to organize their own games, to imagine what they want to imagine. Hail the soccer moms. My daughter is one, but this can get out of hand, and I think it has. We're orchestrating their lives. We're not allowing them to live them among them with their peers in a way that I think is very important for children. It's the same thing for adults. Now, the culture itself is not friendly to friendship anyhow. We could go into that. But I wanted to talk about mentors. Well, I know that the mentor is in jeopardy. When you assign a mentor to somebody or the mentee isn't able to choose the mentor, then the meaning of mentor is lost. The mentor must choose the mentee because the mentor has more in stake than mere friendship. The mentor has at stake, knows there are certain skills that need to be transmitted to the community. That could be dance. Or in the stag's case, the guardian of the deer and the herd of deer, he needs to find another guardian. So he has to train Bambi to have certain virtues in order to succeed the stag. This is very important. Now, in the case of dance, I'm very familiar with. My daughter did ballet right through college. The good ballet instructor is going to inevitably pick out those young women, and it's almost always young women, who have the ability. And that should be allowed the mentor. It's not democratic. And the more we democratize that process of communicating a skill, a trade, an art form, we jeopardize culture also. Yeah. And this democratization process is way out of hand.
I think another thing you mentioned that the mentor is very striking is so the stag, there's two things. You said in contrast to the spirit of modern educational theory, in the mentor-mentee relationship, there lies no distinction between method and content, right? So that by means of physical gesture, tone, voice, behavior, the mentor communicates his special knowledge and skill as a piece of his own character. Yeah. And that you have this, you say here, like there's a connection between the mentor as if a friend.
Yeah.
But at one point when Bambi goes to talk to the stag doesn't know what to say. And that there's a risk in the mentor. Sometimes always like the mentor is the perfect wise one who knows everything, but there's actually a risk. He's like, I didn't know what to say. So he just walked away. And it's hard to, know exactly what to do. It's hard to be a mentor. You're putting yourself at risk. And then there's the second part is the, or the third part, I guess.
You can't afford friendship with Bambi. You can't afford to be a friend to Bambi in the way that particular encounter beckons him perhaps to be. He knows he can't do that. That's hard.
There's a separateness, like, and like even use the monastic, there's a monk, like the monk, of course, meaning from monks means alone or solo.
Right.
There's a soloness. You need to be able to be by yourself. And I actually struck by one section where the stag is vigilant. He's studied, he's put to memory everything. He reminds me of Gandalf, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's something separate from Gandalf and Frodo. There's a friend, but there's a mentor and they're separate and there's risk and tension. And I thought that was quite a beautiful element.
Tolkien knew the difference from his study of literature and myth, folklore.
Yeah, and of course, Tolkien has a great essay on fairy tales too.
Yes. The best.
And so I think that this friendship, and there's something human. And so I liked that in the book, it's everything from nobility to dignity to not being a victim to friendship to understanding both from the mentor and the mentee, that for a child to read it and for an adult to read it, to realize that, I mean, in a sense, this is, to conclude and going back to this, is shapes our moral imagination. And I liked how you said in the beginning that it gives us the impressions that, how do you say, raise up the analogies for us to figure out how to navigate a complex world, whether we're children or even whether adults, as C.S. Lewis says. That's why these fairy tales can be read over and over again, not just by children, by
exactly.
adults.
We can't overplay or do too much to give our children stories. More is better than less. But again, if they want you to read it 10 times, I'd say, do it.
Again.
If it's a good story.
Again. Good. Well, Professor Gorin, thank you very much for taking time to come on the Moral Imagination podcast. I hope we can have you back. I'd love to talk about your book and gardening on Inheriting Paradise. Are there any, just really quick, what are the best editions? And you and I can actually correspond later. And on the show notes for listeners, I will put a list of some of the best books or editions for some of these things. So you can find that at themoralimagination.com. But if you're going to start right now, what, like Blue Fairy book? Do you like those? Do you like the Grimms? What do you recommend people start with to get into reading the best classics?
Editions is an issue, but let me just say, In terms of the Grimms, the blood and the violence that people find in the Grimms, it's not gratuitous. It's deeply embedded in their understanding of redemption and their Christian faith. So I say, read the Grimms. The Grimms and Anderson, they're beautiful. They're very different. Those are classics. They are great literature. They're not just stories for children. They're great literature. The thing you have to do is find the stories in their integrity. And they're, in my book, I've mentioned several collected volumes that are useful. But the problem is that there are no pictures. So I suggest to parents, get my book. I mention a couple of collections of Anderson and the Grimms. Read out of the fullness of those stories, and use a picture book to show pictures, if that's how you've got to do it.
Yeah, that's good advice.
Use the artist to enable you to keep the attention of children, but read the whole story.
And one of my favorites, by the way, is Madame Beaumont, I think, is the writer of The Beauty and the Beast. I love that version. It's very beautiful. It's one of my favorites. And it really, and you talk about Beauty and the Beast in the book. That's probably my favorite fairy tale. It's such a powerful and beautiful story. So,
good. I do talk about it.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right, Mike.
Hope to have you back. And I really appreciate and thank you all for listening to the Moral Imagination podcast. Again, you can find show notes at themoralimagination.com.